On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Microsoft profit slaps its doubters. Apple is circling the wagon. Adobe Flash is dead again. And 5G might be perfect for rural deployment. Plus, Spoon Guru drops in to drop some AI in your diet. It's Wyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 276, recorded February 2nd, 2018. Spoon Guru, AI for your diet. Welcome to Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professionals, the IT pros, and the geeks who just want to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise, but I can't guide you by myself. It's an awfully big world. I'm going to need a little help from my friends, my colleagues, and of course, that's got to start with Mr. Lou Maresca. He is one of the bigwigs over at Microsoft. In fact, we're going to be talking about it a little bit later. His division had a pretty dang good quarter. Lou, how you doing, my friend?
I'm doing fabulous. Doing great. The weather's looking up and feeling better. I had a cold for last week, but otherwise, we're doing great.
I've heard that you're actually in quarantine right now and they won't let you out of your office until everyone is gone. Is that how that works?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's one thing about having an office is great. I get to sequester myself in here if I'm a little sick or not feeling well. So that's what I'm doing today.
Yeah. Folks, here's a public service announcement. If you're ill and you can stay home, please stay home because that's how we spread this wonderful thing that we call the flu. Now, someone who doesn't have the flu is Mr. Curtis Franklin, which is surprising because he just got off a cruise boat for a month. And I thought that was like the thing you do. You get sick, right, Curtis?
You know, I really do hate doing the expected thing. So I came off the cruise ship feeling good, wandered around large groups of people in public, felt great. I figure it's probably solitude that's going to do me in. So I'll try to limit that as much as possible.
Well, gentlemen, we've got a great show for the Twit Ride today. Not only are we going to be covering the news, not only do we have to dive a little bit into 5G and what it might mean for rural communities, but we've got the folks from Spoon Guru who have a few thoughts of what AI is going to do for you in the future. Now, let's go ahead and jump straight in to the blips. Now, on Wednesday, Microsoft posted its earnings report for the second quarter of fiscal 2018 and wowed its investors. Among the highlights, operating income increased 10% to $8.7 billion. Revenue was up 12% to $28.9 billion. And net income stood at $7.5 billion. Now, those numbers sound good for a quarter, but a deeper dive shows exactly why they're good. Surface products nudged just 1%. Windows OEM bumped 4%. Gaming was up by 8%. And enterprise was up by 5%. All relatively unchanged. However, cloud services made a huge impact. Office commercial and cloud jumped 41%, leading to a 10% and 12% increase in revenue in commercial and consumer sides. Dynamics revenue jumped 68%, and Azure saw a revenue growth of 98%. Additionally, it seems that Microsoft pulled off a smooth acquisition for once, as their LinkedIn purchase saw a 20% quarter-over-quarter growth for the fifth consecutive quarter, bringing in revenue of $1.3 billion. Of course, there will be naysayers who will point to some of the flat sectors in the company, but Satya Nadella's cloud-first strategy is paying off in a big way in actual profit and value.
So also, the latest Apple earnings call was this past Thursday, produced some pretty interesting insights about Apple and their device ecosystem. A lot of people spun it in many different ways, which made it look pretty good. But one interesting stat that was there that was interesting is the decline in sales over 1% after that $1,000 iPhone X launch. But historically, Apple has always been underperformed, and they actually underperformed the market as a whole. But its iPhone growth is almost as less than the growth of the market as a whole. But what the data is showing is that Apple's selling fewer iPhones at higher prices, which can actually look pretty good if they sell a lot of those higher priced devices. The size of its universe is actually shrinking, though, as it's charging its remaining customers more for to get their devices to get upgraded. Services, on the other hand, usually grow sequentially in Apple's fiscal first quarter. Well, not this time. Services declined as a percentage of total sales, too, falling from over 15% of sales down to 10%. These signals are potentially showing a danger zone for Apple. It's charging more. It's shrinking its universe from before a product that's may no longer be observable better than its cheaper rivals. On the earnings call, also, a place where Tim Cook normally calls out several times the numbers of people who are switching from Android phones to iPhones, never mentioned the numbers. And when asked, he declined to answer the question. The absence of an answer is almost as good as having the answer sometimes itself. With three new iPhone models in the wind, were similar to the iPhone 10 models, this year's releases and sales will eventually or evidently project a future for Apple and its investors.
Well, surprise, surprise, there's a new vulnerability, and it shows that configuration still matters. Security researchers at F-Secure have found yet another potentially serious security hole in an Intel product, this time in the mechanism for performing system updates. There's good news, though. It seems that the new vulnerability is limited to desktops, and it's a configuration error. The researchers found a flaw in Intel's Active Management Technology, or AMT, a feature that's used to perform remote updates on advanced desktops using Intel vPro or workstation platforms using core desktop chips and a certain Xeon CPUs. Here's the key thing, even if the PCs are turned off. The vulnerability allows a local intruder, keyword is local, to backdoor almost any corporate laptop in a matter of seconds, even if the BIOS password, TPM pin, BitLocker, and login credentials are all in place. The problem is in how some OEMs deal with AMT's BIOS extension, or MEBX, configuration and the BIOS password. The report is yet another reminder that we have to be paying attention to all levels of the hardware and OS configuration. For reality's sake, though, it must be emphasized that this is A, an exploit that requires local access to the computer, B, requires the attacker to be on the same network for further exploits, and C, has absolutely no impact on Xeon servers.
Now, blockchain technology, yes. Cryptocurrency, not so much. This seems to be a trend among countries who are looking at the extreme volatility of popular cryptocurrencies and deciding that the risks are too great. India put the brakes on cryptocurrency a few years back, but yesterday they announced that they do want to explore the use of the blockchain for use as a technology in digital payments. Finance Minister Arun Jaitley included the use of the blockchain as a step to a digital economy in his budget speech on Thursday, specifically with the goal of being a cashless society, also bringing with it the increased risk of untraceable money laundered and shady business deals. He wants to explore the use of a distributed ledger to verify transactions within a cashless society powered by the soon-to-be ubiquitous wireless networking services around India. With a number of countries, such as Iceland, Ecuador, and Vietnam, outright banning Bitcoin and others, such as China, placing curbs on ICOs and Bitcoin-heavy investments, too many are conflating the blockchain with individual cryptocurrencies themselves. So it's refreshing to see a government official seem to speak knowledgeably about the underlying technology and envision its use at the enterprise level for something other than digital financial instruments.
So modern browsers today are disabling Flash by default, and it's more of an opt-in model. That doesn't mean people don't use it, though. Sites are slow to upgrade to the modern-day HTML5, so people are usually forced to use Flash. Well, this latest report shows that millions of people are being affected by the latest bug and an exploit coming out of North Korea state actors due to Flash. According to the security alert issued by the South Korea Computer Emergency Response Team, a zero day that affects Flash players' installs of 28137 and earlier, where a bug is exploited by hiding malicious code into other documents like Microsoft Office, web pages, and spam emails that exploits the Flash bug to infect Windows PCs and other machines with malware. Victims are tricked into opening dodgy documents and then the bug can actually take over the machine via hack that exploits the Flash hole. Adobe is in the process of correcting the issue and will update a large set of versions of Adobe Flash to patch the issue. Windows, Mac, Linux, Chrome OS machines are equally susceptible to exploit. To me, this is one of the first of its kind that affects all platforms other than the hardware exploits from Intel. One workaround, if you're worried about it and you don't think you're going to get the update anytime soon, is to remove Flash. That can't be the first time you've heard that one, though.
If this, then that, and Microsoft Flow are getting some competition from Zoho. Automation is one of the hottest IT topics for 2018, and for proof, you have to look no further than business app suite provider Zoho, which has launched Flow, a workflow automation tool that lets users connect a range of cloud applications to create their own automated processes. Now, users already familiar with IFTTT, or that if this, then that, Zapier, Microsoft Flow, or other app integration tools will find Zoho's approach similar. Each workflow consists of a trigger event followed by one or more actions. Zoho has its own wide range of applications, but Flow can connect to a variety of third-party apps, including some rival platforms. Currently, more than 100 applications are already supported. Now, according to the company, a major differentiator for Zoho Flow is its builder tool, which provides a drag-and-drop interface in which workflows are created and displayed. Zoho Flow costs $10 per organization per month and is available for free as part of the Zoho One subscription service.
Now, it's no secret that telcos and ISPs don't like to build out to rural areas. Though doing exactly that is part of their charter, the price of being granted preferential right-of-way and incumbent status in a functional monopoly of their profit centers, they tend to look at rural areas with disdain as they run either at a loss or with extremely thin margins. In fact, the last decade has seen telcos lobby for the removal of rural deployment requirements, push for a decrease of broadband standards to include much slower wireless connectivity, and outright attempt to deny rural communities any hope of broadband expansion. New York finally got fed up with the eternal delaying tactics, and this week they announced round three of their New York broadband program, which will connect more than 122,000 homes and businesses in rural areas of the state. The program, which has now connected more than 2.4 million locations across New York, targeted areas that Verizon specifically refused to service. In fact, back in 2015, Verizon turned down a $170 million offer to build in this area, saying that no company would run lines out into the sticks. At the press conference, New York Governor Cuomo announced that after Verizon's decision, the state had opened bids for deployment and, counter to what Verizon had claimed, found a plethora of ISPs stepping forward to deploy. Now, here's where it gets interesting. One of those companies in the new bid is Verizon, who will account for $70.7 million of the $210 million deployment cash pot. Evidently, Verizon didn't care about those areas until they realized that more than 20 other companies were about to get a toehold in the state. For their part, Verizon doesn't seem to know how to respond, with their VP of State Government Affairs, Leica Eve, stating, quote, "At Verizon, we don't wait for the future, we build it," unquote. We should probably add, once we're forced to. That does it for the blips. Now let's go ahead and move over to the bites. And we've got to start with something that created a bit of a kerfuffle over the weekend. You may remember that last week, the Trump administration floated the idea of a nationalized 5G network. Now, it was immediately attacked by the telcos, by the ISPs, and even by FCC Chairman Ajit Pai. Now, the admin has since walked back the language, trying to explain it as just one floated idea of many, but we thought that this might be a good time to take a look at what a comprehensive, intelligently planned nationwide 5G network could actually do for some of the underserved parts of the United States. Now, I want to start this discussion with a big caveat here, and Lou and Curtis, I want to get you in on this. I will say unequivocally that wireless, no matter how fast or ubiquitous, is not a replacement for fiber. Would either of you agree or care to take issue with that statement?
I agree. I think, because of the environment and all the signal attenuation, all this stuff, that, you know, wireless is always going to be susceptible to the environment and other things. And with fiber, it's more controlled environment. So I agree with that.
Right.
I think it's highly application dependent. If you're doing business work, if you are pushing video, then absolutely fiber is the way to go. But I think for the vast majority of consumers, 5G could be a very worthwhile replacement for fiber, just because the fact is that most consumers will never need or really use the full bandwidth of fiber to begin with.
Right. And I see that from the point of an end user. However, my point is, at some point you tie it to ground. At some point it has to tie into the network. So it doesn't matter how advanced your wireless technology is. If it doesn't tie into a fiber network at some point, it doesn't tie into everything. It just doesn't work. So, I mean, it's one of these things where if you think in terms of fiber deployment as your backbone, and you know that you need to get fiber out there eventually, but you use a fast wireless technology as a stopgap, at least as a way to get that last mile or a way to serve areas that are very problematic to get fiber out to, then I think that still makes the statement true. But let's go ahead and jump into the story, because even with my love for wireless, for Wired, I think wireless does offer huge advantages to rural and underserved areas of the country. Let's look at four things specifically. One, it's cheaper. Now, the Wireless ISP Association estimated that a wireless connection to a rural endpoint could cost as little as one-tenth as much as wiring the same location. Now, Curtis, why is that? What are the costs associated with getting fiber out to a place that might be 2-3 kilometers from a pop?
Well, almost all of the costs are because of the physical nature of fiber. You have to do one of two things. You either have to string it on a pole, or you have to bury it, or more likely some combination of the two. And let's remember that with a lot of the places that we're talking about here, once you get to the customer's mailbox, you may still have a quarter mile or more to go before you actually get to their house. So Right. It's a non-trivial cost, and the population density is such that it's difficult to really distribute that cost over a huge number of customers. And there are some very fixed costs. I mean, if you have to roll a ditch witch and its crew and put all of the stuff in the ground to safely hold fiber, that cost is fixed whether you're talking about serving one customer or 10,000 customers. And it's the fact that we're talking in most parts of the country closer to one than 10,000 that really makes this cost prohibitive.
Precisely. And I think you picked up on the main reason why Verizon and the other large incumbents don't like to do rural. It's because a kilometer of fiber can serve either 1,000 customers or it can serve one. Which would you rather have? Of course, you're going to want the areas that have a lot of customers because that's more profit. However, their charter is to serve even the one that does one customer. Now, this also ties into the second point, which is it's ready for deployment. Lou, I'm going to throw this over to you. This has been something that we've covered on Twiat a lot over the last couple of years, and that is it's complicated. When you want to deploy someplace, it's not as simple as renting a ditch witch, digging up the street, and throwing down some conduit. There's a lot that goes into that actual planning and then deployment. So when they say that wireless is ready for deployment, what are they actually talking about? What's the difference between wireless being ready to deploy and fiber being ready to deploy?
Well, there's two parts. There's obviously the carrier, and there's, you know, the device that's actually giving the signal off, and the device that's accepting it. And when you don't have devices even available today that are supporting this spectrum and the new technology, and then you really don't have a full deployment yet, even though if you might be available on the towers that are being. Also, you know, with 5G being at the high level of the spectrum, much higher frequency, you know, you have to plan out and determine how to do that overlapping coverage. And in order to have a full deployment, having overlapping coverage, especially in an area, you have to make sure you plan that out. And most likely, because 4G is a different technology, you're not necessarily done with it yet. And so they need to basically ensure that the coverage is going to be available to call out a full deployment there. So I think there's a couple parts there that needs to be called out.
Right. Curtis, I like this next part because this dovetails with a lot of the things that you said about when a technology is available and when it becomes, well, actually useful. And that is that wireless 5G, especially in these rural areas, can actually be more reliable. It can be more dependable than fiber. I know that sounds counterintuitive, but existing urban developments have shown that maintenance of rural lines can actually be more of a time and resource sink than the deployment. There's always something going wrong. There's always lines going down, and it becomes very difficult for ISPs to respond to those problems that are so far away from all of their regular concerns. How is it that something like 5G might be more reliable than having a fiber run dropping down into the middle of your community?
Well, once again, we're looking at density issues. They can put a 5G tower up to serve a large number of customers. And therefore, if there's a problem, they have a lot of incentive and a lot of economic incentive to get that tower up and running. Plus, because of regulations that are in place, every cell tower, if it carries voice, it has to have a certain number of hours of battery backup. Many of them also have generator backup. So there is deep redundancy built into a cell tower. That redundancy is not built into every kilometer of fiber that is strung along a country road. And, you know, once you get out of the cities, there is lots and lots of this country that from a fiber run standpoint is pretty hostile territory. I mean, just look at the weather forecast for the weekend. We've got a big winter storm moving across the northern tier of states. That's going to carry with it in many places ice. Ice brings down fiber and copper and everything else. So it's fragile. The radio waves just don't have to deal with that. And the frequencies that are being used are pretty resistant to weather-related interference. So from the point of view of a consumer-level bandwidth requirement, 5G is just a much more resistant, much less brittle medium than is any thing that can be described as cable or fiber.
Yeah, and I know, again, that's counterintuitive, and we've all been trained and we've all had experience of wired/fiber being more reliable than wireless, but again, rural areas play by slightly different rules. Oh, the fourth one, and again, this is one of those kind of counterintuitive things, is that it can actually be faster than typical wire to these locations. You have to remember that with the distances that we're talking about, you're always going to get a loss of signal, be it copper or fiber, and you're going to need a lot of equipment to repeat that signal. Well, with the current state of 5G, and remember, we don't have a standard. We don't have a technology that we can say is 5G, but we're looking at a combination of technologies, millimeter wave radios, something up in the 600 megahertz range and 600 hertz range, UHF radio, a combination of these is what we're actually looking at when we do 5G deployment. Right now, they're saying with the technology that we have, you're looking at a minimum of 50 megabits per second. And with the gear that they're looking at and the standards that they might include in the 5G standard, you could be up to 200 megabits per second non-line of sight, which is amazing. That's, if they could actually make that work, that would be fantastic. You know, make it work outside of the lab. So let's go ahead and take those. Those are the four reasons why we might want to consider a 5G network, especially in rural areas. Right now, the FCC is estimating that there are 20 million Americans living in rural areas that don't get any sort of broadband service at all. So we can look at this and say, this could be a way for us to get out to that. These people, these communities have been waiting for decades, for literally decades, watching the broadband revolution pass them by. And they're starting to realize that this is not just email and surfing, that there's an entire part of the economy that they could be participating in if they just had broadband. Curtis, I want to throw this over to you, though. 20 million Americans looking at a broadband deployment of 5G across the nation that's going to cost billions of dollars. There's going to be people who do the cost analysis on this and say, maybe the incumbents have it right. Maybe we don't deploy to rural areas. What's the response to that?
Well, you can see that, and I think what we have here are the limits of pure capitalism, and it becomes a very philosophical thing. The pure capitalist, pure free market fans would say that we let the market, let the incumbents figure it out, while others point at the potential advantages to the broader economy and to these 20 million citizens. And say that it's worth some sort of societal investment in them, whether that investment is made through the government or through the higher tariffs all of us will pay if the incumbent wireless providers are required by regulation to provide this. Personally, I think that there is a compelling case to be made for doing some sort of nationwide 5G coverage. I'm much less entrenched about the mechanism that's used for that idea. But I think that pretty much blanket coverage of the nation by 5G has a lot of good things going for it. And I would be in favor of it, recognizing that because I live in a place that's already served by broadband, I would end up paying for it. Hey, it's what neighbors do. But I think that there is a lot of business to be unlocked out there. I have covered a lot of agriculture, for example, and it's astounding what the agricultural users, the agriculture industry is doing with its current level of bandwidth. Food production will become safer and the facilities will become more productive with better broadband. And I think that's the kind of thing that makes it an advantage for everyone.
Yeah, it's we've got a very good conversation going on in our chat right now between Chumley CR1, Y Guy, and Emily the Strange, talking about this, exactly this idea of there's a couple of different ways you can look at this. Like you, Curtis, I fall into this category of you could actually advance these areas quite a bit. There's a lot you can do with a broadband connection on a farm. I know it sounds weird. I know it sounds like that's not a good matchup, but it's amazing to look at what some of these technologies can actually do for the production on farms. The other part, and Lou, I'd love to get your input on this is what we do. This was the promise. This is not an add-on. When we started giving right-of-way to these companies that have deployed networks across this country, this was part of the agreement. This is, if you remember, we used to have the rural telephone fee, and that was to say, look, the cities are going to subsidize the deployment of networks out into these rural areas, which the telcos never really did. So we kind of let them off the hook on that for the last couple of decades. But that doesn't mean that we're not still supposed to do it. We're not arguing whether or not these communities should be served. We're arguing how they should be served. And now we have a technology that can do it much more quickly and much faster than with technologies in the past. So, Lou, for you, I mean, how do we sell that to the people? You know, having in the back of our mind that we shouldn't really have to sell this to the people?
That's a hard question. I think that, you know, the telcos, if they're kind of forced to do what they're supposed to be doing, they're going to go back and do whatever's cheapest. And so in order for them to serve the public correctly and be able to bring forth all the advantages of some of the newer networks, you know, the people are going to have to step in and start and voicing their opinions and get their representatives to represent them correctly. And I think, you know, again, because the rural environments don't have this technology today, they tend to not know what they're missing. And so kind of pushing the envelope there is going to be really difficult, you know, without a campaign to bring those people forth, right? And so I think that that's what's going to be the main problem, is somebody's going to have to take that responsibility to bring the people along with them, as well as, you know, market this capability to bring telecom companies actually come forward and do the work. Otherwise, if they're forced to do it, they're just going to go back and say, you know what, we'll just implement, you know, 2G or 3G in some areas to get people on board, and then we'll, you know, we'll fulfill our promise. So,
all right, I want to throw one last bit out, and in either of you can answer this. There is a concern here that in order to entice the telcos to do this, we have to do something that even this show has been very against, and that is allowing the telcos to get out of their responsibilities, their previously established responsibilities, to deploy to urban areas if they're willing to make the investment into wireless infrastructure. Is that a compromise that we have to make? I mean, I think that's why the nationalization discussion came up, which is let's still hold the telcos to their agreement to deploy to rural areas eventually, but we'll use a nationalized network in order to get to them now. What's the right tact here? What's the right strategy? How do we make sure the telcos do what they said they were going to do and at the same time get service to these people in some sort of timely fashion? Anybody?
Well, I'll leap into this particular pit of twisty, turny arguments, because I think that the real issue is that we're talking about encouraging the wireless companies to do something on a national basis, when in many cases the actual implementation regulations, requirements, and all that happen at a state level. So one of the great things to be decided is whether this becomes a truly national issue or it remains at the state. Again, I think there's a compelling case to be made for doing something on the national level, just because we do regulate the spectrum at a national level. And so the effective way to do it is somehow tying it to spectrum licensing and allocation. The problem is that we have an FCC that has just swept away network neutrality rules. It's very difficult for me to foresee a scenario in which they would decide that they're going to throw this level of regulation onto the wireless carriers, which leaves market forces. And well, we see how well that's working so far. I'm not sure what we do to get market forces to work better.
Yeah. Lou, last word to you.
I think Curtis said it well.
Well, gentlemen, we're going to have to come back to this discussion in the very near future. It's not going to go away because, well, we're a networking show, and this is about as big networking as we get in this country. But it's time for my favorite part of every show, and that's when we bring in guests, experts from the outside who can drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And I am so happy to welcome to the show two individuals. That's right. We've got Marcus Stripp and Simon O'Regan, the CEO and CTO and co-founders of Spoon Guru. Marcus, Simon, thank you very much for coming on to This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thank you.
Yeah. Now, gentlemen, I'm going to do the buzzwords really quickly. The Spoon Guru is talking about the B2B movement, the food industry that is now thinking about using AI to help the world's dietary needs. That's the buzz. But before we get to the buzz, let's start with you and let's start with Spoon Guru. How would you describe what Spoon Guru was founded upon?
Well, in a nutshell, we are a food search and discovery platform, and we want to simplify the whole food search process for people who've got specific dietary requirements. That's why we got together and why we set up the company. We want to make it easy, less cumbersome, less frustrating for people to find whatever it is they're looking for.
Let's talk about what you're making easier. What is so frustrating, what is so cumbersome right now with the industry the way that it is about finding a particular dietary path?
As soon as you have some form of dietary requirement, your choice is immediately and drastically reduced. Nielsen published a study last year that showed that 64% of the world population is now on some form of diet. And people go on diets for a number of reasons, whether it's for religious reasons or for medical reasons or for aspiration reasons. But the fact of the matter is, as soon as you decide to go on an exclusion diet, you start to struggle. You start to struggle to find suitable foods, whether you try to find foods online or in a physical store. When we first got together, we became aware of this problem through personal circumstances, and we saw the struggle firsthand, and we decided to do something about this. We decided to use smart technology to address this problem. Even Google, you know, when you go to Google today and you try to find vegan sausages, Google struggles to find accurate search results for that specific need. And that is a simple use case. You know, what happens if you've got a household that's affected by multiple allergies? The husband may be on a religious diet. The daughter may be on a low sugar diet. If you have multiple dietary requirements, you pretty much, you know, you're completely lost trying to find anything that matches your needs. And we are trying to solve that problem. And really, when we started out, we only knew two things. We knew there was enormous demand from people trying to find specific foods or recipes for their needs. And we knew there was a phenomenal amount of supply out there. You know, the free from market in the US alone is $24 billion. The products are out there, the demand is out there for people trying to find these products, but what seems to be missing is a bit in the middle. And that's what we're trying to solve.
Of course, we do have to highlight the fact that when you're talking about dietary restrictions, it could be any sort of dietary restrictions. You've already mentioned allergies. Some people will do dietary restrictions for health. Others will do it for religious reasons. Others will do it because of their geographical location. When you're using the search engine, what are you specifically trying to do? Are you trying to maintain certain types of nutrition? Are you trying to make sure that people are actually eating healthy? What are the different criteria that I can pour into my dietary search for a particular region, religion, culture?
So our platform supports more than 180 dietary tags. And you're absolutely right, Robert. They range from the religious dietary restrictions to health diets or, veganism or preferences, food preferences. Some people may prefer to be on a gluten-free diet as a lifestyle choice, whereas others may be affected by celiac disease and they have no other choice but to eat gluten-free foods. We are not trying to judge. We are fundamentally neutral and objective.
Right.
We allow our users to tell us what it is they're trying to avoid, or what food preferences they have, and if it exists, we'll try to find it. That's what we're trying to do in the first instance. We also support a number of healthy diets and aspirational diets, and obviously we would like to encourage people to embrace more healthy lifestyles, but we don't really... Our number one objective is to simplify the whole food search and discovery process, and we don't judge. You know, you may be on a paleo diet, which may not be the best diet for you from a medical perspective, but if you choose that diet as a lifestyle choice, we simply help you find suitable products and recipes for that requirement.
Oh, we've got PS Chops in our chat room. He has a very insightful question, and he's wondering if your search engine can help deal with food scarcity in certain regions. For example, if I've got a dietary restriction, can I use your app to make sure that I can have all my nutritional needs met within an area that maybe has a food scarcity of particular foodstuffs? Does that work into the engine at all?
Well, what it will certainly do is it will expand the number of foods that are available to you on any particular diet. It sounds really simple, but many foods aren't actually labeled as, many vegetables aren't labeled as suitable for vegetarian, for example. I know that sounds very trivial, but actually once you get complex dietary restrictions, the foods that are specifically labeled for that restriction also narrow in choice very much. So what the engine will do is greatly increase the number of foods that would be available to you on any particular dietary regime or restriction. So from that perspective, yes, in the sense that there may be foods out there that you're not aware that may fit your profile, we would be able to offer those foods to you.
All right, so take me from start to finish. Let's say someone downloads your app. They've got a dietary preference. They've got a dietary need. What are the things that they can do with your app? What are the things that they can search for with your app? And what does your app connect them with? Take me through the whole process.
So the app is available for free on Android and iOS. And you first time user downloads the app, and then you are encouraged to set up a profile. Some of our users actually just use the app to find any kind of food. But you're really encouraged to set up your profile. And that is the first... what you can see on the screen now, here the first, this is the onboarding experience. We support more than 108 different dietary preferences in the app, and we continuously launch new dietary preferences. You can choose between intolerances and allergies, and if you want to configure a lifestyle preference on top, for example, you may have a nut allergy, but you also happen to be on a low-sugar diet, or you prefer a meat-free diet. Once your profile is set, we are fundamentally a search engine, and we search hundreds of thousands of food products and recipes to find exactly those that match your needs. So once your profile is set, every single product you see or every single recipe you see will match your specific requirements. If you're on a gluten-free diet, we wouldn't show you any recipes of food products that contain gluten. So not only does it make it very safe for people to find appropriate foods, it simplifies the whole process. There's also a powerful barcode scanner in the app. So if you're in a supermarket environment and you want immediate feedback on whether a product is suitable for you, you don't need to read the list of ingredients. You don't need to work out what an E204 number is. You simply scan the barcode and the app tells you immediately, yes, it's okay for you, or no, put it back.
Now, how are you getting this information? Is this all hand-entered, or is there some database that you're tapping?
We have sort of aggregate suppliers for all of the recipes, and I think we have about 120 1,000 US products approximately. And I think approximately similar number of recipes. So we aggregate these. We then, on a daily basis, we add new products and recipes, and we run the machine learning and AI models across all of the attributes of all of those recipes and products on a daily basis. So we're continuously refreshing the products and the attributes that are assigned to them.
Who do you see as the key demographic for this service? I mean, I see the utility, and I think it's actually quite interesting to categorize foods according to dietary restrictions. That's never been done before. But in your mind, going out 5-10 years, who do you see being the loyal audience of Spoon Guru?
My personal view is that this technology should virtually disappear within 10 years because it should be ubiquitous. You shouldn't be looking even at, if you're shopping or you're looking at recipes or you're in a restaurant, you should automatically be offered products, recipes, meals that suit your dietary requirements. It should become part of the infrastructure of the way food is distributed and sold and purchased.
Well, let me ask you a little bit about that, because this is information that actually, if people are looking, it is available. I mean, you can find the dietary information about the things that you are eating. Do you think it's a lack of desire to actually know what people are eating? Or is there really a lack of understanding of how dietary restrictions work?
I think it's not always available, in the sense that not everyone knows what all of the E numbers mean. There are certain E numbers that, depending on the provenance of the ingredient, it may be vegan or it may be vegetarian or it may be neither. I think that although food labeling is getting slightly better, the actual data that's out there is quite dirty data, quite messy in a lot of ways. It's also very confusing for the consumer very often to have to read the packet and cross-reference maybe two or three items to see if they meet a particular criteria.
All right, we have to ask this because, well, one of the most popular shows in our network is all about security, and we have a popular axiom of trust no one. Users are setting up accounts. They're putting in dietary restrictions. That is personally identifiable information. That is sensitive information. What do you do with it? How do you make sure that your users are going to stay secure? How do you make sure that that data can actually do good things for them while maintaining a level of privacy?
Sure. I mean, for a start, all of the data is encrypted as it's held on the services. Any scans we do across the data or, you know, usage structures, it is all anonymized. The only actual information we take from users is an email address, and that is held in an encrypted form on secure services.
Okay. And I want to go back a little bit to one of the comments that you made, that eventually you'd like to see this app disappear. And I think that that's because Spoon Guru is really a B2B platform. That's what you want. That's your lineage. That's where you're looking for. So in 10 years, when the app disappears, where do you see Spoon Guru? I mean, obviously you're not trying to make your company go away. You're trying to evolve it. So what's that next step?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's as you correctly pointed out, it's really that we don't want to see the function disappear. We started off with a very kind of focused problem that we wanted to solve, and we'd like to see this problem solved everywhere for everybody. So we'd like to see it as part of the whole sort of food supply chain. And in that sense, we'd like to see Spoon Guru as a company that can help bring that about.
All right. I want to go ahead and bring in my co-host into the discussion, because I've been watching them in the display monitors, and they're kind of bobbing their heads and they're listening to this. Curtis, Lou, I don't know of any other company that's doing this. I know companies that are trying to offer nutritional packages, companies like Blue Apron, which is sponsor of the network. They do this sort of things on the macro level. I don't know of a company that allowed me to search for dietary restrictions. Can you think of any?
I can't. think of any write-off. The other services here in the U.S., their response to something like this is to provide you with the food rather right. than provide you with information about food that you would procure yourself. So I think that this is a most interesting model. You know, one of the things that I'm curious about, and I would love to ask our guests, when you looked at this need, you've talked about the artificial intelligence, the machine learning concepts. Was this a case where you looked at the need and instantly said, well, what we need to do is go out and build our own artificial intelligence capability? Or did you decide on the need and then go out looking for a platform that provided that intelligence for you? Can you tell us a little bit about how the build out to this point has happened?
Sure. I mean, essentially, this really started with us thinking this muscle already exists. Surely there's such a need. We felt there was such a need from our personal experience and various other things. So initially, we started a research to find, you know, where is this? It must exist somewhere. And upon finding, we couldn't find that it existed anywhere. We took a look at the problem from a data perspective and worked out whether it would be feasible, which we considered it was feasible, given the right amount of resourcing. So we really built from the fact that there's definitely a problem here, we consider. There should be a solution in this day and age. There's a wonderful kind of confluence of the fact that, you know, the processing power, the data, potentially the data, although it's very dirty data and needs a lot of cleaning. These things, I think 10 years ago, you couldn't really do this, or you'd need, you know, such a huge amount of resources that probably guys like us in a startup couldn't really bring those resources to bear. And I think it's the combination of the fact that the data is available, the resources are available to a startup, and you know, obviously, it's taken us a lot of time to get to this point, but we did feel it was something that a soluble problem, providing we applied the right resources to it.
And this is the hump where you're a startup, you've got a great product, you've got something that's unique, something that no one else is doing, and now you need to find a way to grow it. Lou, you actually have experience with this, right? What's the key hurdle that they have to jump over in order to start really seeing acceptance?
So, you know, like a lot of individual organizations today, like Celiac Disease Foundation, I've had some family members that have celiac disease. They offer this ability to go search, and they have kind of an aggregation of several providers that give you kind of like recipes for specific food types. But I think for this particular scenario, you know, a lot of organizations, you know, I like to go back to like MLS systems where they have data. It's in a different format per sometimes even region in a state. And there's like no real easy way to kind of aggregate all that data. And so, again, you have to cleanse it and format it and transform it and do all those special things. But one interesting way of kind of getting over that hurdle is standardizing the data format and providing that standard to providers of something like maybe recipes in this case, or food providers like Blue Apron and so on, and giving them the advantage of, hey, we can broadcast and market your service via our service by just, you know, giving us data about what you offer and relating it back to dietary restrictions. Has that been something that you have done or maybe done and reached out to these companies and talked to them about that and maybe provided some kind of a standardized way of or format to provide that data and, you know, maybe open source it or so on?
Simon can answer the open source question. In direct conversations with large corporations around the world, in order to help them make sense of their own data set. Every single corporation, whether it's an FMCG company or a large retailer, recognizes the problem. They understand the consumer demand. They can't satisfy it adequately. And we are now, our business model is based on B2B revenues. You know, we started out as an app. We still have an app in the marketplace. It's a great R&D tool for us. It's a gift, effectively, to people out there struggling. We intend to keep it for free. We make money through licensing our technologies to large corporations, and that allows us to reach millions and millions of people, literally, and improve their quality of life, and help them with their struggle to find suitable foods. The standardization is an interesting question, and we've been approached by a number of bodies who understand the need for a standard. I don't know whether us as a startup are best positioned to drive that kind of conversation, or whether it needs to be driven by large corporations. We are happy to work with anybody. Our entire philosophy is based on how can we use technology to simplify the whole process and make it easier for people to find whatever it is they're looking for. That's what we do. We've built a product that has solved that specific use case, and now we are happy to license it to anybody who's got an application for it.
Now, gentlemen, we've got an interesting conversation going on in our chat room with Chumley, JJ to the 4884, Heretic Specs. They're looking at the nutritional side of the service. One of the things that they're bringing up is, unfortunately, most of us in the developed world didn't pay attention in nutrition class, or we didn't even have nutrition class. And so we don't actually understand that you kind of do need a balanced diet, and you need to make sure that you're taking care of the dietary needs of your body, no matter what your diet might actually be. Is that something that Spoon Guru can help with? I mean, is that a specific function?
Yeah, absolutely. There are a number of healthy diets you can select within the app. So you can set a low sugar preference, for example, or a low salt preference, or a high fiber preference. And we're about to roll out a number of proprietary diets with a partner of ours around cholesterol management, blood pressure management, weight and wellness management. And we are getting really excited about those type of diets. In addition to supporting the traditional restrictions, you know, whether it's an allergy or whether you need to be on a weight loss diet, we really want to encourage people to become healthier. And you know, I personally would love to be on a healthy diet if it was made easy for me, but I simply can't be bothered to read the back of a packet and work out how much salt per day is good for me, how much sugar is good for me, where are the thresholds. And if there was an app like Spoon Guru that would make it easier for me, I would absolutely use that to find products and to cook, you know, to find suitable recipes.
You know, Lou, this strikes me as the kind of app that I would probably spend a bit of time just messing around on it, finding out, hey, you know what, if I were to go on an X diet, where could I get my protein from? So let's say I'm going to go on a low cholesterol diet, so I'm probably not going to be eating much meat. I'm assuming Spoon Guru can say, hey, these are the alternate sources of protein that will replace what you're losing because you're not eating meat. That's cool. And actually, I think that's actually the gameability, the appability of this service, which is people can actually start saying, oh, that substitutes for this and that substitutes for this. The other part of this question is, and this has come up in the chat room several times, what would this do for people who live in, you know, what we call food deserts? And that could be out in the middle of nowhere, or it could be in the middle of a city where it's not just dietary restrictions. There's actually a restriction on the types of food you can get.
You know, so again, the starting point is we look at what is available, and we search that data set, and we filter out whatever is suited to you specifically. So if you're, you know, in a certain area where the amount of product is limited, then we would analyze that limited data set and simply bring to the surface whatever it is that is the most appropriate for you. But again, it's all about what we do is about tailored choice and personalization, and we just make it much easier for you to find whatever it is you're looking for within that given data.
It's about kind of showing you the foods that you can eat, as opposed to many diets are defined by telling you the foods that you can't eat, which is fine, but it's not that useful when you're trying to find something to eat. Right. You actually, you know, but telling you the foods you can eat, we feel, is a more useful function in some ways.
I'm right with you, because I've seen some of those nutritional apps before, and they're very good at telling me the things I should avoid, not so good at telling me things I should eat that are actually available in my area, which I think that's the strength of your approach. All right, let me ask the vision question here. Is your ultimate goal to be acquired? I mean, is Spoon Guru destined to have a technology that an Amazon or another logistical giant can say, this is something we can roll into our service and make it that much better? Or is your long-term plan to say, no, Spoon Guru is going to stay independent for the next 50 years?
No. Our vision is we want to see the end of consumer struggle. We want this capability to be ubiquitous wherever you are on the planet. Food search should not be difficult in this day and age. You know, when Google is mapping the ocean floors and Elon Musk is putting somebody on Mars within our lifetime, the fact that you can't find gluten-free vegan sausages is crazy. That use case we want to see solved within the next 3 years. And we are a tiny startup. You know, we're growing rapidly, but we're still tiny compared to the big corporations. So sooner or later, we will be teaming up. We are really looking forward to teaming up with global partners who can help us scale this business globally and make the functionality ubiquitous.
What I like about this is you could be using Spoon Guru if you're vegan, if you're paleo, if you're all meat, if you're all rocks, whatever it might be. I really like that aspect of the service.
We don't judge.
And specifically if you have more than one dietary requirement as well. So because you're a celiac doesn't mean you might not be a vegetarian as well, or may not also be allergic to nuts. So it's really about trying to help people with combinations of dietary requirements
and we love that. You know, when we first started out, we made the assumption, you know, you've got a bunch of allergy sufferers over there, and you've got a number of vegans over there, and maybe you've got some fitness fanatics over there. And we can, of course, support all of these segments. But what we're seeing now from our own data set is that people have multiple food preferences. What Simon has just said, you know, an average app user on our app has selected 3.3 food preferences. And we absolutely love that. We love the fact that everybody's unique. And we want to celebrate that. You tell us what it is you like and what you don't like. And if it exists, we will find it for you. And that's all we need to do. it sounds easy. The other thing I love about this is the problem is very clearly articulated. It's very clearly defined. It's incredibly hard to solve. But we've done a phenomenal job, I think, at having a good crack at it. And it is validated in the marketplace. Now, I don't know whether you know, but our first client who licenses our technology is the world's second biggest supermarket, Tesco's in the UK. They came to us. They realized they had the same problem. You know, their customers were looking for foods, and they were searching with specific dietary preferences, and they struggle to surface those products. And now they're licensing our technology to power their online grocery search. And that is, again, this is fantastic for us because we immediately reach millions of people through our partners and through partners like Tesco.
Marcus, Simon, this has been an absolute pleasure. It's always fun to step a little bit out of our box. This is not a typical fair that we would have on This Week in Enterprise Tech, but I'm so happy that we covered it. Unique solution, unique company. Gentlemen, if you could, please tell our audience where they can find you, where they can find your app. This is your time. Take the next 30 seconds and plug away.
So you just go to Spoon.guru to find more information on our company. The apps are available for free for download in the app stores. And let us know what you think. You know, we respond to feedback. That's another big advantage we can bring to the table. We love to hear from our users. We respond to requirements. That's all we do. You know, we're not trying to second guess what people may want. You tell us what your frustrations are, and if you can solve it through a smart application of technology, we will try our best to do that.
There you have it. For non-judgmental food searches, you got to try out Spoon Guru. Again, we've been speaking with Marcus Stripp and Simon O'Regan. That's the CEO and the CTO and co-founders of Spoon Guru, using AI to help B2B and, all the food that's coming to your table. Gentlemen, thank you very much for giving knowledge to This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Folks, you've done it again. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 food groups. I want to thank everyone who made this show possible. Of course, to our engineers, of course, to the people here in the studio, but definitely to my co-host, without whom I wouldn't want to do this show. Curtis, let's start with you. Where can people find you? Where can people find your work? And what will you be up to the next couple of weeks of winter?
Well, if they want to find me and my work, the best thing to do is to follow me on Twitter. That's at KG4GWA, because when I publish something, I almost always link to it there. And as for me, on Monday, I'll be heading down to the BICSI conference in Orlando. For those who don't know, BICSI is the organization that certifies cable monkeys. If you're talking about the physical plant of networking and data center communications, you're talking the language of BICSI. So I'm going to be down talking to a lot of cable folks. We'll probably have a report on that this time next week. And again, follow me on Twitter, because I'll be taking pictures and reporting on it live there.
Fantastic. Thanks, Curtis. And also to Lou Maresca. That's right, folks. When he wakes up in the morning and he sees a shadow, it means we're going to have six more weeks of winter. Lou, where can people find you and the Kick Arse Dynamics team over at Microsoft?
Well, you can always find me. Actually, I'm in the Office team now. So you can always find me at the dev.office.com, where all of the Office add-in capability, extensibility stuff is there. All my work on Office add-ins can be found there. And, of course, you could always find me, you know, little projects I'm doing, things I'm posting at Twitter as well, at twitter.com/LouMM. Check it out and reach out to me.
Lou, Curtis, thank you. And also, thank you. That's right. The person who's watching or listening to this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech, we wouldn't have a show without you. And we want to thank you for years and years of supporting the show by making it a little easier for you to get your enterprise fix. Just go over to our show page at twit.tv/Twiet. That's T-W-I-E-T. There you'll find all of our back episodes along with the show notes. If there was a story that we covered in our bites or our blips, you're going to find it there. It's a really good way to also find contact information for our guests. So, for example, if you want to talk to the Spoon Guru guys, if you've got an idea for something that they need to include in their service, again, you're going to find it there, twit.tv/Twiet. As long as you're there, why not subscribe? If you want to make sure that you never miss an episode, you can get an audio version, a video version, or a high-definition video version into your device of choice automatically each week. Again, twit.tv/Twiet. Also, while you're following us there, why not follow me at twitter.com/PadreSJ? If you follow me there, you're going to find out what we're going to be doing each week on the shows that I host. You see what I do when I'm not at the studio. Like, oh, I don't know, the last time I checked, I was recreating an Elon Musk flamethrower in the courtyard of St. Ignatius, which I had to take down because someone told me that that was irresponsible and immature and not worthy of a priest. But I'm probably going to do it anyway. So again, go to twitter.com/PadreASJ. Finally, thanks to everyone here who makes the show possible, to Lisa and Leo who have let us do this show for years and years and years, to my engineer, Alex, the man Gumpel, and also to my TD, Kevin. Now, Kevin, this is the time of the show where we offer you a chance at redemption. Every week, we ask you a little bit of information that came out each show to see if you were paying attention. So are you ready for this week's question?
I'm as ready as I usually am.
Okay. According to the Spoon Guru service, what is the perfect superfood?
Strawberries.
I'm sorry, the answer was pizza, but thank you for playing. We'll try again next week.
I would love that.
Until then, I'm Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.